First, we got to move the book. I wave my hands, and I knock stuff over. So, hi, everybody. I'm Belinda, an alcoholic. Oh, my God. I would tell Darren, I was like, stop setting me up for failure here. But I appreciate it. Yeah, hopefully I'll remember the note that just fell on the ground. But first of all, like, it's always a privilege and honor to speak anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous or to be of service. And so thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I want to thank Lee for asking me and communicating with me. I really appreciate it. I met him a couple of years ago, and him and his wife, and it was always nice to see his name. And we try to do this. I think the first year y'all didn't have it. I was supposed to speak, so thank you for having me back. Sissy, it's nice to meet you. I don't even see you in here right now. Thank you. And Harry, oh my God, my new best friend Harry, he's a hoot. You come in hot, and I just automatically love you, man. It's like, Mo has been a wonderful and gracious gift. I get off the plane, I says, I have checked baggage, and she said, okay, and then as I'm walking off, I gotta go to the bathroom, and she said, oh my God, you're so high maintenance. And I'm like, I said, I think I'm gonna get along real well with this girl. First of all, Lee, you know, thank you for believing in me, and thank you for the service work that you do. Because of people like you, you've saved me. I've listened to 100 of speaker CDs, and it's hard work these guys do, and so thank you. Then the speakers, you know, Jane and Jane, I've loved you since the day I met you a few years ago, and every time I think of your name, it warms my heart. But to spend time with you and be in your presence, I can't even put words in it. Thank you. Barbara and Dick, it's great to have finally met you both and got to know you a little bit better. I appreciate it. All of y'all, including Lee, share just a message of hope from the heart. And thank you. And then Don's not here, and it's always good to hear him as well. And my note's down there, so if I forgot anybody, I'm sorry. I want to start off, and you don't have to do this with me, but if you will, if you just close your eyes for a minute and then just take a deep breath in and breathe in God and breathe out fear. Breathe in God and breathe out fear. And just one more time, breathe in God and breathe out fear. Now, if you just open your eyes, and just for one moment, I want you to feel the shift that took place in the room. I'm grateful I was taught that as one of my earliest meditations. That is meditation. I started that off with 1 minute at the beginning when I first got sober and continued it and changed some other stuff up. So if you don't think you can meditate, there's an example. Hopefully I'll talk a little bit more about my meditation life later. I'm extremely passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only has it saved my life, it's changed my life, it's given me a life I never dreamed of. All the promises that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about has come true in my life. In 1941, Bill Wilson wrote that our chief responsibility is an adequate presentation to the newcomers. So welcome, newcomers. And with the help of a higher power, hopefully, that I'll be able to do that. But how do you adequately present a program that is life-changing and been around for over 80 years? How do you adequately do that? And so hopefully, I've been trying to get quiet, and I'll just allow God to speak in and through me. The God in me does see the God in you, and it is a beautiful sight, I must say. I'm so grateful that I got hooked up with some people that believe in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and has guided me with lots of wisdom and lots of experience. But the truth is, like, so growing up, you know, I loved horses and softball and dance and gymnastics, and I knew for sure I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my dad. I mean, that was off the table. I saw the destruction in the home. I saw the fight. I grew up in fear. It was just a lot, you know. And so, sports and horses saved me for a long time. I loved it. I felt a part of, and there was joy in that, right? And I had a good time. And no matter what was going on in my home or on the outside, I had just this, especially with horses, this love and peace that they brought me every time on the inside. I didn't know I had this it going on the inside. Everything I'm going to share today is just a reflection of what's happened over the 57 years of my life. What my truth today is may not be my truth tomorrow, and I'm really grateful that that is my experience. My truth when I first got sober, November 18th of 2008, thank God that is not my truth today, right? And so, you know, my dad quit drinking when I was 12, and that's when I started. My mom started Al-Anon when I was 3 years old in 1967 and has been an active, faithful member of Al-Anon of service. She's a past delegate, and she works the steps, and she sponsors women, and she's still of service, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. But that wasn't enough for me to get and stay sober. I grew up in Alateen. We had a great time. That's when AA and Al-Anon and Alateen was just this big family fellowship, and they were healing together and they had fun together. But also some of those Alateens were some people I used to drink with, right? A couple of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous now as well. One of them died of alcoholism. But my dad got sober 9 years after my mom was in Al-Anon in 1976. You know, and the truth is that I don't remember when it started, but after he got sober, he was molesting me. And that just reminds me that the darkness within can still be here when we're sober. The things that I'm going to tell you about doesn't make me alcoholic, like him molesting me, growing up in fear, looking out under my door, my bedroom door every day before I came out. That does not make me alcoholic. But what I can tell you, alcohol gave me a sense of ease and comfort. It was in addition to the sports and the horses. It gave me ease and comfort. Now, my first drink, I don't know that I remember my first drink either, but I can tell you the first time I got drunk, I was the youngest of most of my, of my siblings and most of my cousins, and we go to the country, and I mean, they're in the country, kind of like here, maybe even a little more, one red light actually, so more. But they bring me to this party, and I don't know, you know, they say, they start drinking. I can't tell you what it was that I drank, but it was clear liquid out of a bottle. Now, I had no intention on sucking face with a boy when I'm 12 and him putting a hickey on my neck. I didn't want that to happen. But once I put alcohol in my body, I mean, I knew because my dad, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. And here I am in the sixth grade, sucking face with a boy in the country, and he puts a hickey on my neck. So I remember that first morning that I woke up after that, though, I was full of guilt, remorse, and shame. And then I started hiding and putting makeup on. And I mean, I'm up here telling y'all I'm sucking face with a boy. Those are the things after I'm like, I can't believe I said that. I spent a lifetime doing that, I might add. But anyway. Oh, gosh. But that next morning I was just trying to hide it. I was already trying to hide the consequences of my actions. And so growing up, you know, I mean, I spent like my childhood trying to hide from my dad and always stay covered up and do all of these things. I met my first husband when I was 15, and you know, he was a little physically abusive, but I married him anyway. I mean, why not? I was kind of used to that turmoil and the fights and the chaos that was in the home. But I got married right out of high school. I passed up a softball scholarship. It was more important. I just had this inside desire. I wanted to be loved so bad. I just wanted you to love me. And I was willing to do that at all costs. You know, in high school, I was suspended when I was in 10th grade because I drank a little bit too much. I overshot the mark. I didn't even make it to first hour. There was a group of us. Other people were doing drugs. I wasn't going to do drugs, but it was okay to drink before school. And, you know, I didn't intend to drink so much that I couldn't even walk to my locker. And it was funny because by this time my dad had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, the principal or the counselor or whatever calls him, and they pick me up, and it seemed like he wasn't mad. It seemed like he understood. But remember, Remember, by this time, he's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course I got punished. You know, I was in a youth group, and I drank before youth group, of course, with those Alateen friends, and I got a little slap on the wrist. Don't do that. And but this, you know, I remember another time my parents went out of town, probably to an AA conference, by the way, because they did it all the time. And I had a party. And it was just going to be a few friends. It turned into about 100 friends. And by the end of the night, I've got people throwing up all over the bed. I've got pool furniture in the pool, and it's winter time. Somebody ran into the, you know, dented the sheetrock in the garage. And, oh, my gosh, I was so frightened I'd get found out. Another time in high school, I drank so much. I think Lee mentioned it. Strawberry Hill. Mine was Tickle Pink. Right? And I drank so much one night. And I remember racing with that bottle. And God, I got so sick. And man, I just never wanted to get so sick and throw up again. You know? And so many times I drank so much I'd throw up again. And I didn't want to throw up again. And that was repeated over and over and over. So that first husband I married, I thought he drank too much because he drank every day. And God, because that's what my dad did. My dad, when he was drinking, he drank every single day. And so for some reason in my mind, even though I went to Alateen, I formed this belief that you have to drink every single day to be alcoholic. You see, because since I wasn't going to be an alcoholic like my dad, I was not going to drink every day. And so that husband, he drank every day. But there was something about him. He could drink just a couple. He might wallow in the grass, come in, have dinner, watch the news, go to bed. But since I had formed this belief that in order to be an alcoholic, you drink every day, I kind of thought he was an alcoholic. Now, it didn't deter me from marrying him, of course. And so even when he wasn't drinking, we'd have these fights, and I was defended, and I was trying to protect myself, and you know, and that's just kind of how it went on. I remember I was in banking, and somebody says, "Belinda, you know, I don't think you're yourself when you're around him." And I'm thinking, what do you mean? I'm only myself around him. I'm kind of the actor with everyone else. But what it was is with that physical abuse and that smothering and all of that, I was walking on eggshells just like I did growing up. And so at some point I decided to leave that husband, but I was really afraid for my life, so I made a plan. The plan worked out. The first night I went to the bar and got wasted. Of course, I was throwing up. Didn't want to throw up. I didn't want to black out. I didn't want to forget how I drove home. And this is repeated over and over and over again. When I left that first husband, the party was on. Party. And it was fun. I think it was fun. I had a great time. I went to a different bar every night of the week except Monday because I wasn't going to drink on Monday. I didn't want to be an alcoholic like my dad. Right? But I had a plan. There was always a plan. This bar has little snacks before. I mean, anybody, like, if you eat, then you won't drink so much or get so drunk, right? So I'm going to eat. And I mean, it was always, and man, stay off the tequila. Tequila makes me fight. And, you know, I'm just going to switch to Jägermeister. Well, Jägermeister made me fight, too. I love to fight when I drink. I just love to fight. What I know now is I just had so much angst and anger within me. I'm not one of those that's going to back down and cower in the corner. I'm going to blow up big because I'm so scared and I'm coming at you hard. People really feared for my sanity, like the book says. I mean, it still baffles me that I can't even imagine that. I mean, it takes a lot of anger to do that. I just can't even imagine, but I can almost feel what it felt like then. I mean, I had some great times. Cruises, and you know, I'm from South Louisiana. There's a lot of festivals, and it was fun. And then somewhere along the way, you know, I met that second husband, and you know, he was doing cocaine. I wasn't going to do cocaine. We were just dating, and once he got off my back, I thought I'd try it. Now, when I'm going to talk about drugs, it's going to be very little about drugs. I believe in the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am 100% alcoholic, but I started adding drugs because if I do a little cocaine, I can drink more. In the morning you take a few pills, you can, you know, it helps the hangover. Whatever delusion I was in, but I spent the rest of my life, because I drank from 12 years old to 44. I drank for over 32 years, and I added a lot of drugs to my story. And so that second marriage was a couple decades long of sexual abuse. Sexual abuse does not make me an alcoholic either. But what it does, it made for great drinking. And I would try to be the woman that he wanted me to be and do the things that he wanted me to do, and I hated it. Just like I hated what my dad did to me, I hated it. There was nothing about it I wanted to do, but I wanted to be loved so bad. I remember one night I was just crying and crying because I couldn't do what he wanted me to do. And he was like, don't worry about it. And I just felt like if I couldn't do this for him, he wouldn't love me. And I was heartbroken. But boy, I really did. It fueled my drinking. It fueled the other drugs that I had to add to it. Right? And so somewhere in that, you know, probably about 10 months before I got sober, the truth is I thought crack cocaine was my problem. If I just get off the crack, everything was going to be okay. Even then, I had no idea alcohol was causing any issues in my life. I hear some of y'all thinking, for me, yeah, I'm alcoholic. I just thought that meant I could drink more than you, but I didn't know I had a problem with alcohol. I remember, you know, because I've handcuffs, yeah, a couple times, you know, and I thought it was because of that. If I just stop doing that, everything's going to be okay. And by this time, I had gotten in a really bad motorcycle accident, spent weeks in the hospital, had to learn to walk again. But I'm hooked up to one pump and snorting some other stuff on the side in the hospital. I didn't draw a sober breath for 8 years before I got here. Every single day, I had all kind of stuff in my body. For days, I'd stay up. I'd pass out until I'd wake up only to, you know, it was like when I would come to, really, because maybe things were starting to wear off, I'd have to do more, and I'd have to do more. And I was so restless, irritable, and discontented, completely unsatisfied with life, and I had a darkness within that I didn't even know what the problem was. And I found myself now, the cop husband that I was married to was in another room. We were divorced by now. He thought if he divorced me that maybe I would stop doing what I was doing. But I was so selfish and self-centered, me and my boyfriend were living in the other room. That's the way I thought these things were okay. But one day I found myself in this bed and I'm begging these two guys to blow my head off and put me out of my misery. I couldn't imagine trying to get up and do it all over one more time. I was out of money. I was out of drugs. I was out of alcohol. I was out of food. I don't know how I still had the roof over my head. And I'm begging them to blow my head off and put me out of my misery. And then so something happened and I said, well, because I'm out of all of this and I haven't been out in years, I don't want to go through the withdrawals again. So I think detox might be a good idea. But I'm just going to go so I don't have to withdraw off the pain pills. And then I'm going to quit smoking. I'm going to do that. I'm going to get out and I'm going to manage my pain pills better. I don't think alcohol is a problem at all. And I'm just going to stop smoking that stuff because that's why I lost all my money. And that's why, you know, I'm had broken relationships, hadn't had a job forever. I mean, I was just in this such delusional state. It still blows my mind how asleep I was. Now that was my plan. But what I know now that I didn't know then, something was happening to me, not by me. Something was happening to me, not by me. I didn't swear off again. I didn't say I'm never going to do it again. I didn't make the broken promises again. I had no intention on getting sober. But that first day I'm in detox, what happened is a group of members of Alcoholics Anonymous walked in. I had two big books with me. Now, I had only been to AA once because when I said I was going to quit smoking crack, if I couldn't quit smoking crack, I'm going to go to AA. And I went to one AA meeting, loaded out of my mind, I might add. Picked up a desire chip. God only knows what I said, if I said anything at all. And AA didn't work for me that day. AA did not work. That was my one experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm pretty sure my dad had given one of my partners a big book because he thought he had a problem with drinking. I don't know where the other one came from. I brought two big books with me. Because by this time, my dad had been the sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for over 30 years, and my mom had been in Al-Anon for over 40. And so this group of members come in. I don't remember. The only thing I remember any of them saying is one guy had just gotten out of treatment the week before, and he had 5 weeks of sobriety. And again, I don't know that I knew it then, but I know it now. That guy saved my life. Because as I sat there at 44 years old and been drinking for so long, I realized I had not gone 5 weeks without putting something in my body to make me feel different. You know, I'm going to skip to just this part. After I get sober, I go to my dad's home group some, and I meet a guy, and he's like, "Oh my God, your dad saved my life." And he was in a sober living house and went to my dad's home group, and he's telling me this. And then at some point I found out that that guy was 5 weeks, the guy that loved my dad and said my dad saved his life, that was his sponsor. It just baffles me that that's how that whole thing works. Now again, I didn't intend to get sober. I didn't intend to go to treatment. Something happened to me, not by me. I remember sitting in that detox, you know, that counselor's office or whatever, and next thing you know, they're giving me some treatments and interruptions, and treatment is not a requirement. It's just my experience. And the next thing you know, I'm calling mommy and daddy again, and they're bringing me to treatment. Now, I forgot to mention the part, because when mom, of course, I called mommy and daddy to bring me to detox, right? And dad gets in the car. He said, "Well, Belinda, are you a drug addict or an alcoholic?" I'm like, "I'm a drug addict, daddy." That's how asleep I was to my alcoholism. I was so asleep to that. And so I think one of my responsibilities in Alcoholics Anonymous, there are a lot of others and us, people other than alcoholic in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of my first responsibilities is to ask you some questions and provide you some information, like the literature says, to help you determine by your learned experience as to whether or not you can concede to your innermost self that you're alcoholic. Because if somebody would not have done that with me, I probably wouldn't be here. I see it often, and other people come into the rooms and think they're just this. But thank God people like you provided me this information and asked me some questions to say, from the moment I started drinking, or the first memory of drinking at 12, I always drink alcoholically. I remember one time, just one time out of all my drinking, I only remember this, maybe it happened more. I remember one night I was at a business function, and the week before I drank, I overshot the mark. I said, "I'm just going to have just one or two, and that's it." And that night I managed to only have one or two, and I'm going to tell you, I was miserable. That was before I really started, because I didn't add all that other stuff till I was 28. But I remember that day I was looking for some other stuff, because one or two wasn't enough. It didn't calm the soul sickness. It didn't calm the mind down. And so I'm grateful when I start looking at, I mean, the book's pretty clear. Every alcoholic has one symptom in common. Once I start drinking, I can't control the amount I take. And so I ask new women or people, it's like, set all that other stuff aside. Let's look at your drinking. What's your first memory of drinking? What does it look like once you start? What's your second experience? What's your third experience? Well, let's look at your drinking. And 9 out of 10 times they're like, "Oh my God." Kind of like I was, "Oh my God, I am alcoholic." So I beg of you, if you're not sure, and you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't lie saying you're alcoholic if you're not sure. I think Dick, and I get the speakers mixed up, so I don't remember who said what at this point, but I think it was Dick, you know, ask for help. See me after the meeting if you're not sure. I'll be happy to do what's been done with me so I can help you concede to your innermost self based on your experience as to whether or not you're alcoholic. There's one rant. So I end up in this treatment center. I didn't intend to go to treatment. And remember, I was just going to get out and manage next time. And I'm grateful. And I heard some people talk about Joe McHugh. And he's deceased now. I can say his last name. But it was a place that it was his recovery plan. And I'm so grateful. The place that I went to, you sat through class Monday through Friday, 8 to 4. And they brought you through the first 103 pages of the big book. And in 28 days, they brought you through it twice. Every night you had homework, and every night you did assignments. And every night you would do an inventory. They'd sign you a sponsor. You did all the steps. I mean, all the steps. You shared an inventory with someone. They left you in your room to do 6 and 7 in that hour. I mean, do an hour and then do 6 and 7. You had your amends list and your harms list and your amends ready. They talked to you about 10, 11, and 12, and I am so grateful for that. No, I don't remember. So, you know, yeah, talk to you about getting a sponsor and a home group and go to meetings and stuff like that. And next thing you know, I'm going into a sober living house. It's happening to me, not by me. I can't even, like, when I sit right here thinking about that, I didn't make a decision to do this. I don't even know how to describe it. But I'm in that sober living house now. And I'm grateful because they had restrictions and you had to be at home at a certain time. Absolutely no men in the house, right? Of course, I snuck my boyfriend in the window, but... Yeah, I could have skipped that one too. But I'm grateful. And so my mom's like, get this woman to sponsor you or that woman to sponsor you. And then come to find out that woman's old and I don't know about that one, but I ended up going with the old lady and I was like, how could we possibly relate and stuff? And then I scheduled a meeting with her, and 2 days before that, my 28-year-old beautiful niece, I got the call, and she had died. She had took pills and passed out in the car and froze to death in South Louisiana. And I remember the look on my mom's face. She thought maybe I would end up drinking over it. But I didn't. I didn't make the decision, I'm not going to drink. It happened to me, not by me. I knew I owed that girl an amends, but I didn't have a chance yet. So anyway, I ended up coming up with a better plan, and I got another sponsor and worked with her for a couple of months. And then I was like, oh, she's too young, doesn't have the experience. She always has to ask her sponsor. So I got the hardcore sponsor, and I worked with her a while, and I didn't like, I'll just say, it didn't work out. I came up with another plan. I ended up back with that old lady. She is currently 51 years sober. She is 87 years old. And she is my heart. She has been one of the most gentlest, finest examples of Alcoholics Anonymous. She doesn't drive anymore. She sits at home. She has her little calendar and people come. Every day she has sponsees come. She's one of those people that always wants the newcomer. Always. Belinda, I don't have a newcomer. You got a newcomer for me? You know anybody, any newcomers? If you show up at her home group and she doesn't know you, she will push people out of the way. She's only 89 pounds really, or maybe 95 now, but she will push people out of the way to get to you. And I'm so grateful that she led by example in that area. There's a few things in the book, and I, you know, for whatever reason, I marked a few pages this morning, and I'm not going to read much, but I think one of the speakers mentioned it last night, but it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. That is the purpose of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful you taught me that. There's also a part in here. It says it also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. So I ask you, especially you back there, do you want permanent recovery or temporary recovery? Because if you want permanent, there is a solution. I learned how to pray out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just love it. My experience is even though I've had that same sponsor for over 13 years, I have been blessed to work the steps with many other women. So usually once a year or every other year, I will find another woman that I admire, that I know that does this deal, that remains teachable, that walks me through this solution again and again and again. I'm going to quit looking at the book. There's a part in the book that says we face two alternatives. We can go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation, which is the ick on the inside and the mind that won't stop. I can continue to do that like I've done that all my life. Or here's the other alternative. Accept spiritual help. I remember before I got sober, my mom was, Belinda, I'm concerned about your drinking. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, I mean, I literally was so blind. I was like, what are you talking about? I was in such denial and delusion. And then she throws this in. Belinda, pray and ask God. And I literally wanted to throw up. The book talks about it, you know. I bristled with antagonism. The last thing I wanted you to do was mention that God thing again, because I was felt like such a piece of crap. He wasn't going to help somebody like me. And if you tell me that's the solution, I am screwed. My dad used to tell me, I want to talk to you and come by. And I'm like, oh, no way, because I kind of knew what he wanted to talk about. So when I look at the steps, I'm powerless over alcohol. In fact, in most every meeting, we read how it works, right? And it says there is one that has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Not later, now. One power. I'm not only powerless over alcohol, I am powerless over everything. In fact, the book tells me lack of power is my dilemma. I don't get power back. I cannot. Belinda, this human being, does not have power, nor will I ever. I am connected to a power that not only relieves me of my alcoholism, but that power works in and through me. That power gives me power. I didn't believe any of that. I did what you told me to do in this book. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That's what happened to me. I'm not only powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over everything. I have no power on what's going to happen here in a little bit. I love what it says on page 24 of the book. I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to go there. So I hear people in meetings all the time, I choose not to drink. Have you ever heard a woman say, oh, I'm not going to drink because I'm pregnant? Or, oh, no, I'm not going to drink. I'm going to go to jail. By the way, I was facing jail time. That wasn't enough to get me sober either. On page 24, it says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, meaning it's unclear to me, I have lost the power of choice in drink. If I could have chosen, I would have chose not to do what I was doing. It says our so-called willpower. I am a strong-willed individual. Can you tell? It says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness, into my mind, with sufficient force, the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. So meaning, I can't play the tape all the way out. I can't think how bad it was. I can't think about I'm going to go to jail or not talk to my family or I'm going to end up in another abusive relationship. I can't bring that into mind. It says we are without defense against the first drink. I never get the defense back. The defense must come from a power greater than me. I don't get to choose. It happens to me, not by me. Thank God there is a solution. So with step one, it says, you know, and talks about my life's unmanageable. So when I look at this whole process of the big book and the steps, I know it helped me recover. It's so far has helped me stay stopped. Since the day I came in, not counting the one day that I picked up that desire chip when I was loaded. Since the day I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't drank again, but it's only by the grace of a power greater than me. It's not of me. It's happening to me, not by me. But I have to do some things. My life is unmanageable. It was unmanageable before I got here. Look at all the external stuff. It sucked. But what I'm currently trying to manage is the ick on the inside, that restlessness, irritability, and the discontentedness, the angst, that tight chest, that tight in the gut. And I'm trying to manage this to calm my mind. Currently. So when I look at the steps, what is my current experience? Do I believe there is a solution to living life today? Is it in here? I believe it's all in here. Now, sometimes it might tell me I got to go out of here to do some other things. But any problem I have in my life today is in here. So when I look at life, not just about my drinking and the experiences I was sharing, it's absolutely insane. I'm trying to look at the time because, yep, fire. Okay. It's absolutely insane the way I was living life before I got here, but I can tell you my life can get insane currently. Like, my mom on this cruise, and, you know, she's in the scooter, and she likes the rabbit mode, because go fast. I'm like, she's Al-Anon. She, you know I like that, but why would you? But it's like, if she would just listen to me and stop doing those things and not drive so quick, she wouldn't be running into the glass case and running over people. I mean, it's crazy stuff. But I tell you what, immediately with stuff like that, I can go completely insane. I'm no longer of sound mind, not just about my alcoholism, but living life. So do I believe, or am I willing to currently believe? And look, I'm all about getting sober with the same information, but what is my current experience? We talk, look, we meet frequently so that the newcomer can find the fellowship they seek. Thank God. But there's people who's been sober, that's gone through the steps once, or maybe never, and they're dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not one of those who believes the newcomer's the most important person in the room. I need them. I need y'all. But thank God for the old people who have wisdom and experience, and they can tell me about the trials and low spots in their life to share their solution with me. So I can become, so currently, not just when I got here, but currently, do I believe right now? May you find him now. Do I currently believe right now there's a power greater than me that can restore me to a sound mind about anything? About my relationship, about my mama, about speaking, about showing up, about, you know, all of that. And then there's step three. Because the step's kind of like the rigorous honesty of the program. I've got to concede to my innermost self, then I can be rigorously honest. But currently, the reality with a capital R is right here, right now, I'm powerless. That's rigorous honesty for me to continue to understand the reality that I have no power. Step three, not only when I first got sober, but on a regular basis, I've got to make this decision to turn this this jacked up thinking and my action or inaction, that's a lot of times I just need to take no action at all, over to the care of this God of my understanding. I love how the book says you can choose your own conception of God. I didn't have to have my mom's idea or some religious belief, choose my own conception. And so if you're in here and you don't want that God, for me, God was good, orderly direction at first. And if you want to keep it simple, right here, if you don't have one, if you want to choose, right here, right now, do you want a God of love? And if the answer is yes, you have a God of your understanding. So the rest of the time that I speak, anytime I mention God, just think of love. Or whatever has a meaning to you. The big book describes me clearly. It says that I'm the actor. My motive is good. I mean, I want life to be great, and I want your life to be great. My motive is good. But when things don't go my way, I'm going to flip. Because, I mean, if it's good, I'm going to be kind, loving, and gracious. Today, when I think I have plenty of time, because I've been up for several hours, and then I'm praying and meditating and reading some stuff, and then I'm like, oh, my God, I got to get ready. I'm snippy. Wait, Hannah, I'm snippy. She said something, I can't listen right now. I'm like, ugh. And then finally I had to go stop and get quiet. I'm kind and loving and gracious, but if I'm late, I'm snippy. The book says, lack of power is my dilemma. Lack of power currently is my dilemma. I must find a power by which I can live. That power will solve all my problems. My real problem is lack of power. I have one problem, lack of power. I rest satisfaction and happiness. I mean, I'm like trying to rest satisfaction and happiness out of this world by not only managing my life, but managing their life. And if you just uncross your legs and you sit down and you stop talking and you start talking, life would be great. But the truth is I am selfish. The book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of my trouble. That's the angst on the inside. I'm never getting what I want. And when I get what I want, it's not what I want. I want more. I'm a more kind of girl, even standing up here right now. One of my favorite lines, even currently, might change later. It says, the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Oh, I usually don't think so. I think you are, but not little old me. Couldn't possibly. My motive is good. I love what the big book says in the inventory, talking about resentment's the number one offender. It uses words, resentment, number one offender. It's deadly, it's poison, it kills, it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. So if you have a resentment, you're dying inside and maybe you don't even know it. What resentments do to me is festers and feeds the soul sickness. But yet I love me some justified anger. But this stuff just feeds the soul sickness and puts an angst inside of me. And if I don't master, like the book says, these resentments, it's telling me I'm sure to drink again. So there's a beautiful process in the big book of how to write inventory. But this inventory that so many people fear, and I beg of you, if you're in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing about how horrible this four step is, and it's, oh my God, please stop. Please stop. Because that new person back there that we meet frequently so that they can find the fellowship they seek, why on earth would they want to do something like that? Now, I'm here to tell you, it wasn't always the easiest thing. It still isn't always the easiest thing. But what that does, it leads me to a space of that angst and ick on the inside, that darkness in my soul. And it transforms me to live in freedom. Free. I'm so grateful there's a prayer in there. I can't wish the resentments away any more than I could alcohol. I learned to pray in Alcoholics Anonymous right there. God, save me from being angry. And I've been so angry, I've clapped my hands and said, God, save me from being effing angry. I didn't say effing, just to let you know. But when I do these things and I say these prayers, so many times in the book it says we ask. There's a shift that takes place in my soul. There's a fear inventory. I didn't know I was riddled by fear because I thought I wasn't afraid of anything. Thank God there's a fear prayer. There's an inventory process for that, and there's a fear prayer. I asked God to remove my fear and direct my attention to what He would have me be. Because fear, I mean, the book says driven. I am driven. Driven by fear. Driven. By fear and self-delusion, self-seeking and self-pity. I'm not getting what I want. And then that conduct inventory. I'm here to say that my... really. My conduct, my sex conduct sucked when I was first sober. It just does. And to be real honest... Man, you get me on a spiritually fit day and I can find more than one good-looking guy in a meeting. And when I find more than one good-looking guy in a... God, am I saying this right now? When I find more than one good-looking guy in a meeting, there is something wrong with my spiritual condition. I am awake enough to know and have enough information about myself. There is something wrong with my spiritual condition. But what I'm so grateful for, when I was newly sober and I just wanted to be loved so bad, my ease and comfort, the solution to the ick on the inside was gone. I found it in men. It was... Oh, no. Well, the book uses the words. It was never about sex. Oh, but I would have sex with you because it made me feel, it did something for me. And it wasn't never about the sex. It was about the way I felt so unworthy and so unlovable and so full of guilt, remorse, and shame. It fixed me for a while until it didn't. You know, there's that, you know, I was talking about resentments and how deadly resentments are. There's one resentment prayer. But in the sex inventory or the conduct inventory of the book, there are three prayers about sex. Three. Go figure. Two of them are on page 69. So if you're not sure which prayer, remember 69. Two of them are on 69. Two of them are on there. God. Am I red? Looking hot here. Sorry. Oh my gosh. And one of them's on 70. Sex was very troublesome for me. It's obviously trouble for a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill, it's three times in here. One of them says, I pray and ask God to mold my ideas and help me live up to them. One of them says, we pray about each specific matter. The right answer will come. When, oh my God, I despise, don't date the newcomer. Horrible, bad, don't. Until I was 3 years sober and he walked in. These are the things after I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I said those things. But what I am so grateful for, because I hear it all the time, don't get in a relationship for the first year. Well, I was in one when I got here. I was never out of one for a long time until I was about 3 years sober. Thank God you didn't run me out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, but what my sponsor did was what the big book tells us. She was not the arbiter of my conduct. God alone judges me. She made me do work around each one of them. She made me pray about it. That's why I know the prayer so well. I have more conduct. I mean, I have tons of conduct inventory too. Every single time, sometimes before I would, you know, have sex, I would have to do a conduct inventory. And somewhere around 3 years sober, finally, by the grace of God. Because you see, just like my drinking, I needed to quit long before I wanted to quit, and I wanted to quit long before I quit. Same thing about my sex conduct. I needed to quit long before I wanted to quit, and I wanted to quit long before I quit. Even the newcomer, it was so against my morals and values. The book says morals and values are morals and philosophical convictions galore. I couldn't live up to it even though I'd like to. Even though I was in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I still could not and cannot on my own power. The inventory process, real quick, principal inventory, if you've never heard of it, it was one of the most life-changing things for me. The book says we list people, institutions, and principles. What is a principle? It's a moral rule or belief that is either right or wrong but influences my actions. What are some of my principles? I'm not enough. The role I assign myself, I'm not enough. I didn't do it right. Nobody can hurt me. I can control what people feel. If it's going to get done right, I mean, this thinking mind of all the things I should do, shouldn't do, can do, and can't do. I mean, you don't have to raise your hands, but how many of you think you cannot meditate? Well, there is a belief. There is a belief that is fueling your inaction. Those beliefs that I have are not of God. They are of me. God's either everything or He's nothing. On my own, I can't meditate. So I'm grateful I had a sponsor that just kept taking me through this process and this principal inventory. Heck, I signed my man a role. He should be more affectionate, more supportive, gentle with his words, more caring, more understanding, never get mad. I mean, come on, you know the list is long. I'm not even going to add that one. No. I'll ask forgiveness later for ignoring. But what happens when I assign myself and others a role, when y'all don't live up to that role, I am disturbed. The 12 and 12 in the 10th step says, whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, something is wrong with me. And if you're not doing or meeting the role that I've assigned you, I'm disturbed. And so anyway, in the fourth step, I can do inventory on that. The last principal inventory I did was on sponsorship. There's the belief. I got lots of strong beliefs about sponsorship. The things I think I should do and shouldn't do and y'all sponsor you should do. But what happens is my thinking and my actions based on my belief system about sponsorship. This last inventory, what it revealed to me is that because I am in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can get that beautiful asset and turn it into a liability quick. I can do too much and say yes too much. I believe you can say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sorry, it's just me. If I didn't, I can't imagine how overwhelmed. But what I want to say, when I say no, I want to be led by God, not driven by my belief system. The book says we beg of you to lay aside your prejudices, not just about the spiritual aspect, because the whole program is spiritual, not, you know, lay aside your prejudices about God, but my prejudices about my belief system. I live in this space, I think I know. I think I know everything. I think I know what's best for you and you and me and him. It's killing me. Crushed by a self-imposed crisis. Self is showing up thinking I know everything. God is mystery. I'm grateful that through the process of continuing to work this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, continuing to apply the steps, reworking them, I've been awakened. Step 6 and 7 is a continued lifelong journey. I can't work on my defects. The changes that have happened to me, not by me. If I can change and be kinder and more loving and not show up the way, not say some things I think I shouldn't say, that I would. The amends list, my harms list was long. I just want to share a couple amends with you. That niece that died, so a year anniversary of her death, we got together as a family and sent up helium balloons, and somebody said, let's write little notes. And we each wrote a note, but in that note, what I did write was, Chastity, that was her name. Beautiful blue eyes. You know, I made amends to her for the wrongs that I had caused. But in that note, I said, with God's help, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to help others so they don't die like you. The moment I tied that note on the balloon and sent it up, I was free. Now, fast forward 10 years, her brother, my nephew, is in prison. And I get a message from him. My mom brought him a talk of something I had done, and he listened to it while he was in prison. And I got the message 10 years after I sent up that note. He said, as the person who was closest to her, he said, it is my honor and privilege to tell you she had no ill feelings towards you. That she loved you and would have forgiven you. I mean, I have saved it. But what happened then was even a new freedom. I was already free, but my God, I did it 10 years before and God was still working even when I didn't know it. You know, these women that have to bring me through the steps would tell me to do stupid shit. That's really how I feel about it. Sorry about that. They would tell me, like, I'm a year and a half sober. You know, I did the resentment on my dad a year and a half sober. They tell me to do another resentment. I'm like, no, I'm sorry, 3 years sober. Tell me to do another resentment on my dad. I'm thinking, by this time, my dad had died. He died sober, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm thinking, 3 years sober, why? Why? Stupid. That's stupid. You want me to, stupid. Why do you want me to write out a resentment on my dad? So up until that point, and the way I was thinking or believed, my dad was a good dad and treated me good. When I did that inventory 3 years sober, what happened to me was my dad became what I considered a dry drunk, and I had all this negative belief system about him. He did this, and he wasn't supportive, and And the truth is, I lived the next 9 years thinking he was an ass. Let me just summarize it. And, you know, 2 years ago, another woman told me to do something stupid. She says, you know, why don't you write out a letter on your dad with the information you have now? And I'm thinking, stupid. I already made amends to my dad before he died. No, I did not make amends to my dad for him molesting me. But what I made amends for the harm that I've caused and the wrongs that I did. And so here I am, 12, 11 and a half years sober, and stupid lady makes me write stupid letter to my dad. And I pull it up. I'm going to try to read it really quick. I know I'm running out of time. And so I write. This is April of 2020. I said, God, help me write this letter to my dad. Please reveal the truth to me. I said, Dad, thank you for always wanting the best for me and doing the very best you could. I'm sorry for not listening to your guidance, judging, and manipulating you. I have compassion for you and how you must have felt about life. I see now the darkness in your soul, yet your light was screaming to get out. I used it to keep my distance, stayed away from you emotionally and physically, lied to you and myself. Sorry I wasn't able to communicate with you or turn to you in my need, especially when I was a child. I pray that my heart is softened. Thank you for all your work and service in AA and helping so many. You are a great part of keeping AA around for me. Thanks for lighting a passion and love for AA in me. I forgive you for molesting me and creating so much fear in me. Thank you for doing the best you could with me and the rest of the family. I forgive you for hurting Mom and not treating her like the gentle, loving woman she is. Thank you for this experience. Even though I hated it, it now allows me to help others. I don't know if this is possible, but I release you from any guilt, remorse, and shame. I wish you were here so we could heal together, but pray God can heal your soul. I'm sorry for the things that have happened in your life to you. I can't imagine the pain you had to go through. Thank God that a God of my understanding gave me power and willingness to be able to do that. That was one of the most spiritual experiences I ever had. Dad was a good dad, treated me good. 3 years later, he was just an ass. 2 years ago, reality with a capital R. Let me write that and mean every bit of it. Thank God my sponsor's really big on step 10. And, the book says we're going to try to watch and stay awake for. I'm going to try to watch to see where my motive is good. I'm going to try to watch for resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Because it's coming. It says when these crop up. And it uses words like, I got to treat them. I've got to ask God at once to remove them. It uses words like immediately. Oh, I can look it up. It means now, like now, not later, not tonight. The 10th step is throughout my day. I've got to try to stay awake and watch for the ick when it comes up, the disturbance within, so I can treat it. The treatment comes from prayer. The treatment comes from talking to someone else. The treatment comes from somebody helping me see it from an entirely different angle. I'm so grateful for step 11 that, and so in the book it says now step 11, and then it goes into the nightly review. The nightly review has some great questions on page 82. And then the questions, so I can basically those questions that are not only to see how well I did step 10 throughout my day, but it's also to acknowledge some good qualities. One of the things is God, you want me to acknowledge that I got good qualities? That's like hard. I can tell you how I'm a piece of crap and all these things, but you want me to acknowledge some good qualities about myself? And if you feel the same way, I just want to remind you that the good within you is of God, and it's time for us to live in reality and start acknowledging the good within that is God. I love prayer and meditation. I'm so grateful for prayer and meditation. I'm so grateful for a sponsor that is just like... I used to say, you can work the steps out of order and do meditation, and then I said, no, they're in order for a reason. But what I believe now is you can pray and meditate anytime. It's just in step 11, it gives us some direction. That quick meditation that I did, I love other spiritual books. I was never a reader. I read so much. I just love it. But self-knowledge avails me nothing. It doesn't. It gives me some information. It's God that I got to go to. Now, I don't want to demolish this word. The actual step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, as we understand God, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. I need the knowledge and the power. But I got to seek through prayer and meditation. I don't know about you, but what part of this program can I leave out and stay sober? I mean, look, I get it all the time. Did your dad make amends to you? He did not. Obviously, he did not have to make amends to me to stay sober, but I did. I can tell you I am free from that, and I don't believe he was. I may be wrong, but I don't believe he was. There are so many different ways to meditate. If you can't meditate, breathe in love and breathe out something, whatever. Sit quietly, look at a tree, because you don't have to meditate the way I currently meditate. You don't have to get quiet and sit for 20 minutes. You don't have... Do you like music? We know some of us do, right? But is there a song that brings you peace? The book talks about sitting quietly. Can you sit there quietly and just listen to a song? Because God's in the present moment now. God's here right now. Right now is now. Now. God's here now. But I need to get in the present. He's never left me. He's always within me. The fundamental idea of God is deep down within me. He's here. He's here now. My mind will make me go believe it's not. I get this sense of separation. It's just a sense in my thinking. I feel separate. I feel separate from God. I don't feel connected. Okay, so I get it. I don't feel that way, but we are. The truth is, we always are. It's blotted out by my mind. The ick on my soul. I love how the 12 and 12 talks about soul surgery. There's many forms of prayer and meditation. In the 86 to 88, it talks about thinking, thoughts, mind, decisions many times in that just that section. Many times it says ask, that means we pray. It reminds me too, it says being still and experienced. So when I wake up, I am 100%, I am inexperienced. I have to make that conscious contact with God. I do have to use my mind to make a decision. Trust me, I don't always want to do it. I ask God to help me and then I do it. There are times that I'm okay. Tommy had some major surgery at the end of the year and I couldn't quiet my mind. I'm okay. It's like, okay, I'm not going to make myself do it just to say I did it. I just had to be okay that I did it. Thank God, step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. I've had a spiritual awakening every time I've gone through the steps. The soul sickness continues to be healed. My life continues to be transformed. There continues to be a new attitude and a new freedom and a new outlook of life every time I go through this process. Anytime I'm in the presence of God. I'm so grateful that for sponsorship and other women that have guided me. But I've got a couple of women here that I work with and I'm so blessed that they're in my life. One of them I didn't meet for a long time in person. By the grace of God, because of Zoom, she came to me. We came together. And I'm just going to read these two paragraphs and be done. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When you look back, we realize that the things which come to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates or the disciplines of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. No matter what the present circumstances, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you till then. Thank you.